someone about some of the transplanted ideas that came mainly from England to America in the early colonies. And in order to do that, I need to give you somewhat of a background or a quick survey of what was going on in England in the 17th century. Just by way of refresher, you remember that the Jamestown colony was established in 1607, the Plymouth colony 1520-1521, and in the Cape Cod area, and then the Salem colony for Massachusetts Bay Company around 1530. Probably the best organized of all of these companies in terms of a mass movement was the Massachusetts Bay Colony. They were able to move 25,000 people to America within 10 years. In Virginia, they moved 14,000 people to America in sight of 16 years, but 13,000 of them died. So in terms of mass migration, in terms of number of people coming to this country, the Massachusetts Bay Colony was most successful between the years 1630 and 1640. What was next chronologically? Well, Rhode Island is a break-off. Connecticut, somewhat of a break-off. New York, very small, very limited, very tightly controlled by the Dutch East India Company. And then the southern colonies, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, which are, well, Pennsylvania comes in 1688, around there, and there is a very successful migration there because of William Penn's wise policy. But essentially, in the 17th century, the majority of the people that come to this country come from England. And in the New England area, 95% of the people that settle in the New England area in the 17th century and moving on into the 18th century are from England. So there is a tremendous influence on the ideas that are prevalent in England, particularly the radical ideas. Okay. So maybe just a quick overview of England religiously in the 17th century. Sometimes these century figures get confusing because you're talking about the 1600s. As you move into the 17th century, Queen Elizabeth has been on the throne for 40 some years. She reigns from what? 1556 to, is that right? 1556 to 1603 she died. She's a moderating influence between Anglicanism and Catholicism. Anglicanism is the established church. So over here on the, and Catholicism is sort of booted out. So you have Anglicanism as the established church as you move into the 17th century. However, there is a very deep and widespread desire to purify Anglicanism even farther than it had been purified from Catholicism. So you have branches of Puritanism, or of degrees of purifying the church, that are prevalent in the 17th century, and they will run all the way through the 17th century. And as you know, some of the settlers in Jamestown were Puritans. The settlers in Plymouth were pilgrim, hyper-separatist Puritans, and then the Puritans in Massachusetts Bay Colony were simply the separatist Puritans. Well, there are three groups of these Puritans. There is the Anglican Low Church. I can see I'm going to run out of space, so I'll try to write small. The Low Church of the Anglican movement, which wasn't so much interested in all the rigmarole and the Mickey Mouse and the vestments and so on. So they would go a step further than the high church in terms of purifying Anglicanism. The next group, there were three of these branches of Puritanism, were the Presbyterians. The Presbyterians. Puritans. They were led by a man named Thomas Cartwright, who is very influential in disseminating the Presbyterian ideas. The third group were the Congregational Puritans, and this marks the distinction between the Presbyterians and the Congregationalists, okay? Or the distinction in these last two groups. Now, what was that distinction? What would be the distinction from a Presbyterian Puritan and a Congregational Puritan? A Presbyterian Puritan would go somewhat along with the ecclesiastical lines, like the synod and the presbytery. In other words, to him it was okay to have an ecclesiastical structure under which pastors would be assigned and would work. And those synods would be made up of the presbyteria, which would be a sort of a geographical area that included all the pastors in that area, plus maybe a lay person from each assembly. And these would then assign pastors to various parishes. The difference between that and the Congregational Puritans was that these people would not go along with any type of ecclesiastical overlordship. They said that each local fellowship was to be autonomous to itself. It was to function, it was to call its own pastors. It was to vote on those pastors. It was to stay totally independent of any type of overlordship. It was okay to meet together with other fellowships, but it was not good to organize into some type of a synod. Now, within this group, see, now we have another breakdown. We have a breakdown, and I'm not going to give you the names of these. I just want to show you this last one that's important. We have the independents, and we have the separatists. Separatists. Now, it's these separatists that lead the Plymouth colony. They are for separation of church and state and strictly congregational government. And among the leaders of those was a man named Brown. As I remember, I'm not sure if he's executed or he died. I think he's executed. If you study any Baptist history, they're going to claim this man as one of their own. There's another pair of men, Smith and Robinson. And these are the men who will lead the pilgrims out of England to Holland, back to Plymouth, and then under William Bradford, who was one of these separatist congregation Puritans will found Plymouth. Okay? Now it will be these congregational Puritans that will found Massachusetts Bay Colony. See? That will be the settlement that first is established at Salem first, and then throughout what we know, Massachusetts, Boston, Newport, so on. In other words, these are two separate groups, this 1620 group and this 1630 group. They are not related organically at all in their charters. They're two separate charters that come to this country, one in 1520, 21, and one in 1530. Now, England, you see, in the 17th century, is experiencing more religious turmoil than she did in the 16th century. In the 16th century, with Henry VIII around, all he would do is chop off a few heads. He'd send them to the block in order to control things. But in the 17th century, the king doesn't have that much power. he is in a much weaker position because Parliament is filled with Puritans. In fact, the political situation is going to run something like this in England. And this will give you appreciation more of the reasons why the migration to New England is so heavy in the 16th century from England. England politically, okay, 17th century, same century. Now you start off with Elizabeth dying. We'll get her out of the road fast. She dies in 1603. In her place comes James I, who is a Stuart. He's from Scotland. He was really James VI of Scotland. This is now the Stuart line. Elizabeth was in what line? Tudor. She was a Tudor. She was the last of the Tudors, Queen Elizabeth I. She died 1603. Okay, and she was a unifying factor toward Anglicanism. But James I, he's a weirdo. And he's going to reign from 1603 to 1625. The first thing that happens just about when he comes to the throne is that 1,000 Puritan pastors sign a millenary petition begging to get his ear, and he won't listen to them. He just about throws them out. So he almost sets up the struggle that will ensue in the rest of these centuries. You remember, this is the James after whom the King James Version of the Bible is named. When he dies, somebody worse takes his place, his number one son, who is Charles I. And Charles I decides that he'll even take a more restrictive policy toward the Puritans. And what happens to him eventually? He loses his head, yeah. He is decapitated, he is executed in 1649 by the Puritans. And mainly, the ones that are really in influence then are the Presbyterian Puritans. Charles I is, you remember the struggle between the flatheads and the roundheads, right? Which one was he? He was the roundhead, right? They were the playboys of the age. The first thing that he does, like an idiot, he puts his friend Archbishop Laud in as the Bishop of London. And the first thing that Laud does as the Bishop of London, Episcopal now, he gets the Privy Council to grant the Bishop of London jurisdiction over all areas of liturgy and discipline, over all English subjects, whether they're in England or across the sea. Well, already in 1625, when Laud becomes the Bishop of London, Plymouth Colony is established by these hyper-right-wing separatists. Imagine Bishop Laud saying to the separatists, "I'm sending over the Book of Common Prayer, and I want you to run next Sunday morning service according to the Book of Common Prayer, which means you read this prayer, then you sing this psalm, then you read this passage of Scripture, you stand, you kneel, blah, 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 and so on." Imagine him trying to tell separatists that. Well, he at least received authority to do that. Over the years, the Bishop of London will get the council to issue instructions to the colonial government that no minister or schoolmaster can be received by the colony without the approval of the Bishop of London. Now, it's one thing for the Bishop of London to get the Privy Council to say that. It's another thing to get it enforced in the colony, because they become quite belligerent by that time and quite independent, you see. So what I'm alluding to is that according to the whims of the king and his exercise of his muscle with Parliament, so goes the mass migration to the United States. In other words, under Charles I, severe persecution of Puritans. One of the first things that Archbishop Laud does is say to all the pastors in England, we are going to have one church in England with one liturgy, with one form of worship, and we will follow the Book of Common Prayer. And all the Puritans are, you know, they're thumbing their nose at them. And they are nobody's weak sisters. These Puritans had walked very much by divine viewpoint, and they were greatly blessed in their occupation, and they had become very strongly entrenched as the middle class people in England. By virtue of their success, it was one of the reasons, success breeds success, so many of them won seats in the House of Commons. In fact, they won the majority of the seats in the House of Commons in, I think it was 1628. So you know what idiot Charles does? He just dissolves Parliament. And he decides that he will rule personally. And he's able to do that from 1629 to 1640. But then a man named Cromwell comes on the scene, who is a kind of a happy-go-lucky type Puritan, tremendous sense of humor, but equally as firm in his resolve that he's going to shake off these monsters that are ruling England. Instead of them being the dictators, he's going to dictate. And of course, by 1649, Charles I is decapitated, and you have the Cromwellian era in England. Now, there's a strong Presbyterian influence there, and the Presbyterian move is not far enough for the Puritans, see? So they're still not satisfied until we have the complete purification of the church. Well, one of the things about the English people, you have something like this, you have a Cromwellian period, or the Commonwealth. You have that running from circa 1649. For all practical purposes, it begins before that, to the Restoration, which is in 1660. One of the things about the British people is their loyalty to royalty. That sounds pretty good. By 1660, there is enough influence to restore the Stuarts. And so they recall from the continent Charles II. And he comes back and he's restored to the throne in 1660. Now, somebody in Parliament said that, characterizing Charles II, that he never said anything wrong, but he never thought anything right. In other words, he was kind of a nothing type person. He was able to hang around for 25 years, but he wasn't much of an influence. At the end of those years, or down toward the end of those years, we begin again to have some persecution, not largely due to him, but due to the Bishop of London, and I cannot remember the name. For instance, this is the time when they send Lord so-and-so to be the governor of Massachusetts Bay Colony. What's his name? Begins with an A, doesn't it? Can't remember. They take over Massachusetts Bay Colony. They make it a royal colony, and they send a governor to Massachusetts Bay Colony, an Anglican. And one of the first things he wants to do is to open up all the churches for Anglican believers, for them to follow their practice. He doesn't last too long, of course, in England, but this came at the end of this reign. Now, when he dies, the last of the Stuarts comes to the throne, who happens to be James II, who was a Catholic. He's not going to last. 1685, through 1688, and he is the Catholic brother of Charles. You can't be a Catholic and sit on the throne in England. So he doesn't last. In 1688, he is deported to the continent, and this is the year of what is known as the Glorious Revolution in England. There's not a shot is fired, but they import a man called William of Orange, who marries the sister of Charles, Mary Stuart, and he and Mary Stuart then reign. I don't remember the termination of this state. After these die, then the Hanover line will take over. But the important thing about this is that in 1689, they have the Edict of Toleration passed. Okay? Now, once that happens, you have a recognition of all religions in England, you see. And the Puritans then are free to worship the way they want to. And in many senses, the migration will stop from England. Okay? Okay. So depending on the nature of the relationship of Parliament to the king and the strength of the king in terms of pressurizing people into Anglican forms, Anglican ritual, according to the power of the Bishop of London, who had tremendous powers under certain kings, according to the proportion of that power, so directly proportional was the exit visas to come to the United States, particularly for radicals. And when we're talking about radicals now, we're on the right-hand side of purifying Anglicanism. We are talking either about Congregational Puritans or Separatist Puritans, total Separatists. Now, by the time you get to the end of that century in England, you also have Baptists included into this right-wing element of radicalism in terms of the Church of England. So a number of them are coming to this country. Now, the issue, of course, for us is, what happens when these people come to this country with these plethora of ideas that they have relative to government and what the church was and what the church was not and what the church should be? In other words, the way I look at American history through my eyes is that American history is a sort of an experiment, not so much with democracy. None of them knew what democracy was. American history is an experiment in religious expression, and what can be tolerated and what cannot be tolerated and how it should be tolerated and what the relationship between the church and the state should be and so on. In other words, this country becomes a unique experiment that Europe never had the privilege of enjoying. So that Christianity in the United States is going to take on new expressions and new forms. And the divine institution that we learned about several weeks ago will have probably their most opportune or maximum opportunity of expression eventually in this country, but not immediately. Okay? The American colonies are an experiment in religious expression. Now, what I'd like to hurriedly do, if I can, is to go over a select number of these colonies that are somewhat representative of this experiment and how they work it out or don't work it out, one or the other. In other words, it either is going to move further and further into freedom of expression, or it's going to tighten up, get tighter and tighter, and it's going to stop. It's not going to progress much farther. The first of these colonies that we want to cursorily or quickly look at is Virginia. Virginia is a product, originally, of the London Company. Wait a minute. Maybe we can't start that way, can we? Can we start that way? What is the London Company? What is a company? The London Company was a company like you think of a company. Now, what is a company? Let's see how good we know our economic system. What is a company? Group of investors for what purpose? Profit, to make money. So immediately, when you say it's the London Company, you know they're capitalists. They're interested in making money. Okay? Now, how are they going to make money? Well, they think that in this country, of course, the Spaniards have been over here hauling gold back for 100 years. And they think that in this country there's opportunity for some of that. You know the Spaniards immediately, and the Portuguese immediately got the Pope to issue a papal bull about a line that runs somewhere down through the Cape Verde Islands, north and south, that all land beyond that line belong to Spain and to Portugal and to the Holy Catholic Church. And nobody was allowed to transgress beyond that line. Well, of course, no good Dutchman. You know what a Dutchman is? That's a guy who can borrow from a Scotsman and sell to a Jew and make a profit. No good Dutchman is going to allow that to happen. And England, who has thumbed their nose at these papal bulls for 100 years now, they're not going to let that happen. So. Well, there's opportunities to make money in this country. At least they assume that that's the case. However, that's not the only thing that brings them here. That becomes the means of getting them here. But the major reason why people came to this country, particularly, I would say, particularly in the 17th century, was this problem of religion. They came here to exercise themselves in their faith the way they wanted to do it. And that was their primary purpose. Well, if England laid claim to these countries, then who really ultimately and finally was the final authority over the land? Who would that be under the English system? King. Okay. So in other words, to get permission to be on the property, you had to go through the king. And this then would be a proprietary colony. So here is the London Company, which is set up in this fashion. Here you have the king. Okay? The king is looked upon as being the title head and the owner of all properties within the domain, in the final sense of the word. Okay? Well, he has the right to issue a charter. So he issues charter. This would be in a proprietary colony. All the colonies are proprietary colonies when they first begin. Then the king sees, they are making some money. I need to get in on this. So where he can exercise his weight, throw his weight around, and take away the charter, or revoke the charter, and make it his colony, then it becomes a royal colony. Of the 13 colonies, all begin as proprietary colonies. And at the time of the Revolution, only 4 are proprietary colonies. Maryland, Pennsylvania, both owned by a lord, or William Penn wouldn't accept that, would he? He would not even take his hat off to anybody. He felt that was demeaning to the human race. They have to take, you know, like Governor Love says, "Damn, I want them to stand up." Which is right, they should have stood, right, in honor of the office. But William Penn was so independent that he wouldn't even doff his hat to somebody. So he wouldn't like to be called a lord. But anyhow, he was a proprietor of that thing. The other two colonies were Rhode Island. Yeah, Rhode Island, Connecticut, I think. Which were corporate colonies. They were established on the basis of squatters' rights, and then they incorporated later on. Those four are the only four that are not royal colonies at the time of the Revolution. So all of them start out this way, preparatory colonies. The king issues a charter, and that charter is for private enterprise. In other words, this country was founded on the basis of private enterprise from England. Now, there were two kinds of these private enterprises. There were the trading colonies, or the trading companies, I'm sorry, trading companies. And then there were the Lord Proprietors. This would be like Lord Calvin in Maryland, or William Penn in Pennsylvania. The trading companies would be like Massachusetts Bay Company, Plymouth Company, London Company, sometimes called Virginia Company, and so on. Okay. Now, these, you see, these had almost the rights of a feudal king. They could rule like feudal kings if they wanted to. For instance, they could appoint officials. They could, too, create courts. Now, with Englishmen, this would be very hard to do, but they could do it. They could hear appeals. They could make laws. They could raise militias. And they could establish churches. But they were governed all by one sort of cloud that hung over them, if you could define it. And that was this. They were to grant unto Englishmen all the rights of Englishmen in England. Now, if you could define what the rights of an Englishman was in England, then they were to be limited in their power by that same statement. The problem was enforcing that in this country, you see. Okay? They could also dispense land any way they saw fit. Okay. Now, a general pattern emerges from this. In other words, out of these proprietary colonies, a general pattern of government will emerge. It will be based upon freemen. And freemen would be defined as what? What was a freeman in the original colony? He was a landowner or a stockholder. For instance, when Massachusetts Bay Company comes, now listen to this. Massachusetts Bay Company succeeds in bringing 25,000 people in their first 10 years of existence. There were only 12 free men in the original migration, which meant they appointed the governor, they made the laws, they enforced the laws any way they wanted, any way they saw fit. They were in tight control. And they were not here for 1 year until 109 of the colonists that had been here, who by then owned some land, applied to be freemen. Well, the history of Massachusetts is the history of the letting go of that power by the freemen. But in most of the colonies, these freemen they do have a big say in government and elections. The thing that emerges from this, of course, are general assemblies, eventually, in most of the colonies, elected by freemen. Or appointed by proprietors. Okay? Mercy. Let's get back to Virginia. Maybe I should point out something. Let's point out the other key characteristics of any colony. Virginia, for instance, starts out as a proprietary colony. By 1624, it's taken over by the king, who at that time then would be James. Charles doesn't come into 1625. So James I becomes the owner, so to speak, of Virginia in 1624. Now what does that mean? When these, what was the name of that governor in New England? Began with an A. Anybody remember? Remember they gave him, they threw him and they locked him up, ran him out of town, almost tar and feathered him? No. Under a royal colony, you have the king, and then he appoints the governor. See? And then under that, and that governor will have a commission from the king and a set of instructions. And under him, he'll appoint his own council. In other words, the colonists won't have anything to say about that. But by the time these royal colonies begin to emerge, the colonies are strong enough that they have assembly. And this assembly is representative assembly. In other words, they're elected. They're elected by the landowners, but the assembly makes the laws. Okay? The assembly levies taxes, etc. And the governor was dependent upon the assembly for his what? For his dollars, for his money. In other words, the king didn't give the governor anything, the assembly had to. So the governor, even though he was the king's representative, was somewhat tied to the assembly fiscally, so they could control him a little bit, you see. Okay, let's get on to Virginia. This is the first successful colony that's established, 1607. I'll just have to very hurriedly try to summarize this. Virginia is settled in Jamestown by a number of Puritan Anglicans. And the history of Virginia religiously in its early stages is one of a process of gradual establishment of the Anglican Church. This very early becomes Anglican. Okay? Now the problem in that Anglican system is that the only one who can perform confirmation or ordination in the Anglican system is a bishop. And there are no bishops in the United States until 1784, when Samuel Seabury was appointed the bishop. What was that? Anybody remember? Baltimore? He was the bishop of Baltimore. Well, this colony, of course, I'm sure you know the struggle side of this colony. I won't go into that, but the problem with the Indians and so on. So finally, about 1621, they decide the only kind of a good Indian is a dead Indian. 14,000 come between 1607 and 1624, and only 13,000 live. The thing that I'm interested in is expressing to you is the system that developed in terms of authority. And what happens in Virginia colony, and this happens in most of the southern colonies, is that there is a vestry system that develops. Now that vestry system was a concept of various parishes that grew up with the various settlements as they were founded in Virginia. And within each parish, there was an elected vestry, usually of course, of the most influential people within the parish, usually the biggest landholder or the biggest tobacco producer. And that vestry was elected within a parish to govern the affairs of the parish. Now, one of the reasons for that vestry system, or sort of a diffused system of control in terms of a vestry, was that in the Virginia area and south of that, as you know, the principal method of living was by raising tobacco or raising crops in sort of a plantation type system. In other words, you do not have the small town. The environment is not conducive for the small town that New England was conducive for. New England was not conducive for any type of a plantation system, even though most of the people that came to New England were farmers. So instead of the small town system growing up, where you had a town council, where everybody went to the town meeting, where people could have their say in the town meeting, in this southern rural area, there was a vestry system, and maybe a man from a plantation way over here, another one from way over here, another one from way down here, would be part of the vestry. And when they would decide, we'll meet once a month at such and such a place, and we'll talk over what we should do in terms of this problem or that problem. So there is not as much representative government in terms of a vestry system as there would be in the town hall system. Well, this vestry was also responsible for inviting pastors, okay, from England for the parish. Now, of course, they had to look to the established system for a pastor. They had to go through the chain of command. Once the pastor was sent, then the vestry recommended the pastor to the governor for final appointment. Okay, so what you've got going in terms of a local church pastor, you've got a threefold power struggle. You've got a governor, you've got a vestry, and you've got the pastor. The pastor is the low man on the totem pole. He has less to say about what's going to happen than anybody does. And what the vestry does, in order to maintain their power, to maintain power, if they didn't like the governor necessarily, they may bring a man to the parish as a pastor, and they'd let him there, and they'd never get involved with the governor at all. They just wouldn't recommend it to the governor for installation. Okay? So in the South, then, in terms of appointment of pastors, you have a threefold power struggle. The struggle expresses itself not only in the church. Here you have the governor, who's supposed to be top man. Here you have the vestry, which often was very powerful, and here you have the pastor. And you'll notice the people have very little say in that system. Well, eventually that vestry becomes the local, or the power, or the organ of local government. Now, above them, there would be a General Assembly. Above them was the General Assembly. And it was usually made up of vestrymen. Okay. In that system, the Church of England may have remained in a minority numerically, but it was a very vocal and a very deeply entrenched minority. It was a minority that could control. Consequently, from earliest times, for instance, from 1621 to 1625, there was a levy on all parishioners over 16 years old, to support a pastor. The pastor had to be Anglican. The total percent yearly was to be 1,500 pounds of tobacco that was given to the pastor, 16 barrels of corn. What he did with that was his responsibility. That law begins or marks the beginning of the establishment of the Church of England in Virginia, because they are now taxing all people of a parish to support a state religion, you see? Okay. Any questions about that or addition? That's a very hurried explanation. By 1641, there were 12 vestries set by law. The vestries were chosen by the voters of each parish. After 1660, after the Restoration, the vestries were self-perpetuating, which means they were in the hands of the upper class, socially and economically. Okay. Landowners. Yeah. Yeah. Now, in the General Assembly, you want to remember that these legal bodies sort of evolve. And they usually evolve into two houses, very similar to what you had in England, where you would have one representing sort of the landed people and the other sort of representing common representatives, or the House of Representatives. Now, a very different system. See, what I'm trying to do is be real selective, and a very different system emerges in Massachusetts. So let's just glance very quickly as we can at you almost have to take these separate, because Plymouth, remember that they're separatists. They're separatists, Puritans. They're next, so we might as well, in terms of arriving here. They are separatists, Puritans. And they will be Calvinistic to the core. Okay? Now, to these people, the church equaled the proven elect. You couldn't just say to them, I'm converted, I got converted last week, I'm a believer. You had to prove that you were a believer. You proved that you were a believer, generally by succumbing to all their norms and standards. If they said, don't chew gum on Sunday, then the way you proved that you were one of the elect was that you didn't chew gum on Sunday. If they said, no scrubbing your teeth on Sunday, then you wouldn't scrub your teeth on Sunday. You know, you had to have halitosis on Sunday. You generally proved that you were one of the elect by subscribing to all their legalism. The blue law. Did you read in the morning paper about the blue law in, where was it, New York? Did you read about that this morning? You know the blue law in New York says you're not allowed to sell a Bible or any religious article on Sunday? Day before yesterday, there was somebody arrested in New York who, undercover agents, went into a bookstore and they tried to buy a Bible, and they didn't have enough money, but they had enough money to buy a crucifix. They bought a crucifix and they arrested the owner, because there's still a blue law in New York that says you're not allowed to sell anything religious on Sunday. We still have these in Pennsylvania, where I'm from. A lot of those are a heritage of the Puritan concept of separation. Well, these Plymouth separatists, their government was very simple. Very simple. Remember when the night before they came ashore, 41 of the original members of the Mayflower got together downstairs and signed the Mayflower Compact. Now, the Mayflower Compact was the agreement that they would run the colony, because there already were some signs aboard ship of some rebellion against Calvinistic principles. And they were not going to let that happen. So the Mayflower Compact
is an agreement of the pilgrims, see, aboard ship. It's signed by 41. Okay, this 41 becomes the General Assembly the next day. They are the General Assembly of Plymouth Colony. Now, Plymouth Colony, you remember, did it run to the Connecticut River? I think it did. Here's the Connecticut River. Maybe not. Maybe didn't run that far. Here's Cape Cod, being up around here, and here's Massachusetts. Remember, the hub of the world right here, Boston. Plymouth here. Not Plymouth, Salem. Here's Plymouth down here. This is, can you recognize that? Here's Connecticut, here's Long Island, here's New York over here. The Plymouth Colony is going to exist for almost 100 years. We don't hardly ever hear anything about it. It only ends up with 7,000 people in 1693 when William the Third arbitrarily enters it in Massachusetts. But it's in existence all that time. Well, it begins with these 41. They say, we're the General Assembly, so they have the right to choose the governor. They choose the governor. Who was the first governor? William Bradford? Yeah? I think so. They made the laws. They admitted newcomers. They saw fit. And usually they let anyone in that wanted in, providing they would say, okay, we'll abide by your laws. In practice, they let everybody in. Now, that was okay as long as they were in Plymouth. And any time anybody moved or any other colony was set up, which was quite often, they needed some other means of controlling. So as the settlements grew then, there developed or there emerged a general court. This general court was instituted by the established or by those entrenched officials at the time. The general court was established for the whole colony. And it would take over where that general assembly was. But in local affairs, here we have the basis of the democracy in the United States. In local affairs, you have the town meeting. Now, I don't mean by that if you were in Plymouth and you didn't want to wear your black hat, let's say you wanted to wear a red one, and you stood up and said, I'm going to wear a red hat from now on. That didn't mean that you'd have a chance to wear the red hat. They would ostracize you. You say, I'm going to dress your soul clothes. They would ostracize you. They would put you down so bad you'd feel like a worm. But you still had the right to say it in town meeting if you wanted to. And this town meeting, which was all held in the church because that was the convenient place to hold it, and after all, the church and the state were to operate right hand knowing what the left hand's doing. And the left hand supporting the right hand and the right hand supporting the left hand. In no way did the Pilgrims or the Puritans bring democracy to this country. Their attitude was, you have freedom not to live here. You don't like the way we run it. They were authoritarian because they believed that they were the new Israel. And they were going to establish the holy experiment they were going to set up in this country, the millennial kingdom. So Plymouth stayed small. By the way, under their royal charter, they were not allowed to grant all the freedoms that they did. And they were honest people. They sought royal approval for all the matters that they established, but they never succeeded. They were left virtually alone, Plymouth Colony was, until around 1891 or 1893. The Plymouth Colony was a powerful force for dissension, yet it lived a very orderly life from a Puritan point of view. Okay? The next one was Massachusetts. Massachusetts is also a proprietary colony. In other words, it was a private enterprise situation. But it was kind of a unique experiment. It's really in Massachusetts that the new kingdom is going to be sought. Now, they actually got their charter in 1629, but they don't get to come until 1630. But this group, you want to remember, this Massachusetts Bay Colony, is run by Congregational Puritans. These men were the intense middle class, or a number of them at least, were the intense middle class in England. They were wealthy and they were wise. Their charter was approved in 1529, and John Winthrop was elected the president of the corporation. And John Winthrop decided, instead of leaving the charter back in England with some little type of a board in England, which everybody else had done, he says, why don't we take the charter to America with us? We don't have to tell them, we'll just take the charter with us. So in the year between the time that they left in 1630, John Winthrop fought out or helped encourage the stockholders who weren't coming to sell their stock to those who were. And so in 1630, he took the original charter to America with him. Now, all power in that charter rested with freemen, who were the stockholders, and there were only 12. So they had a sewed-up situation. There were only 12 freemen equal stockholders when they came with the charter. Now, that authorized them, then. Out of the 12, then, they could elect a governor, deputy governor, and 18 assistants. Okay? They can make laws and so on. Okay. Now, one other thing they could do, admit other stockholders, which again would be called freemen. But they don't do that. So as I said before, in the first year that they were here, 109 settlers asked to be, or petitioned them to be freemen. And there is a struggle then in New England or in Massachusetts for control or for position of control. Well, their avowed purpose in their writings of coming here was to build the city of God on earth, the New Israel. They were Puritans, they were Anglican Puritans, but they soon refused to recognize the ministers from the Church of England, those who had been ordained by the Church of England. They brought their own pastor with them, and as the settlements began to spring up, they began to ordain their own ministers from out from among them. And they soon began to refer all theological disputes to these various ministers in these various settlements. So even though they were against the Presbyterian synodical form of ecclesiastical overlordship, in order to control the settlements, they had to get opinions from various pastors. And so they would bring them together, but they looked at it more as simply a fellowship of getting together to try to keep things going the way they wanted it to go. They did not officially organize synods, but they sat together as synods in terms of government. These Puritans saw as their first responsibility, the first responsibility of government, from their point of view, was to punish all departures from Orthodox doctrine and from Orthodox practice. In other words, The state was to sustain the decisions of the church, and the church from the pulpit proclaimed the supremacy of the state as long as the state fulfilled the wishes of the church. So in New England, or in Massachusetts Bay Colony, what you really have is an aristocratic aristocratic theocracy with tight control, the millennial state, the holy experiment. Would it work? Could it work? How could it work? How can it work when you have built into the system, and you want to remember that in the system that they did believe in a regenerated church, that the church was only made up of elect, but what system are they practicing which is in conflict with that? What are they practicing that will bring problems? What ordinance are they practicing? Isn't that true? Here is a church who claims that the church equals proven elect, just like the separatists. But these are the only ones that elect, but they have infant baptism. And the purpose of the infant baptism was not so much to make the kids part of the church, but to bring them under the covenant. They thought this brought them into a form of sanctification for children. But the problem is that those kids are going to grow up and not necessarily be regenerate. Well, if that's true and the majority of the second generation are not regenerated, then how are they going to maintain the new Israel, the millennial state, which is built on the concept of regeneration? That's just one problem. Then what about the dissenters? The ones who won't go along with the system. The one who says, hey, look, 1631, here comes a separatist Anglican, or a separatist pastor from England, 1631. He comes to Plymouth. He moves from Plymouth to Massachusetts Bay Colony. He ends up as a pastor in the Salem Church, in the Salem Congregational Church. He's not there half a year, and he stands up and says, it is wrong, it is contrary to Scripture, for magistrates to try to coerce my soul in terms of matters that are not doctrinal, as for how I dress on Sunday or what I do on Sunday. His name is what? Roger Williams. Roger Williams won't last 4 years. In 1635, the General Assembly meets and says, ship him out. Get him out of here. He's a troublemaker. So they ship him out, and of course he goes and establishes Rhode Island, where you really have the first state that has a form of freedom of religion, soul freedom, freedom of expression. Consequently, all the kooks are going to head to Rhode Island. The Quakers, when they come, Rhode Island becomes their haven. It becomes a jumping off place to go into Massachusetts and here take the Puritan. Well, I think the next time, it's time to quit. And I don't want to quit on the Puritans. I consider the Puritans great people. They have been portrayed to be dispensers of gloom, sort of a dyspeptic type, deacon type, materialistic at heart, but outwardly hypocrites, outwardly pretending to be spiritual, but they're hypocrites. But let me tell you something about those people. Those people had such a tight system and were so industrious and looked upon their work as being done unto the Lord with such a degree that they couldn't miss financially. And they became enormously wealthy. And then their wealth, because they didn't know how to handle it from divine viewpoint, became part of their downfall too. And they made tremendous contributions to this country. They were pioneers. They were fighters against tyranny, even though they set up their own tyrannical state. In practical matters, the Puritans were the most advanced thinkers of the 17th century. And out of them, in the 18th century, will come the greatest intellect that America has ever produced. the man that God used for the Great Awakening in New England, Jonathan Edwards. An awakening was based upon gospel. Are there any questions I could try to answer anything we've done so far? I don't think we've done very far. Yeah, that's right, the geographic. Yeah, New England wasn't conducive to... Right, New England had bad soil and tremendous struggle. What, how many pilgrims lasted? 38 or something out of the 100 and some that landed first year? New England was not conducive to a plantation type system, even though the people were farmers. Now they institute a beautiful system up there. It's the pilgrims do. They should have a communal type system, even though there's private property and so on. The farming was taken care of in a planned, orderly system. And everything was built around the town. In other words, the town would be laid out something like this. Here would be the lot of the people. And you would build your house here. And these lots were very deep. And they were all assigned out. And back here would be your garden. And maybe over here would be the church. It would be right in town. Now, to keep the people from moving out on the farm, these towns were kept small, and then the farming areas were all the same. Over here would be a field for the cows, and all the cows would be put over there. You see. Here would be a field for grain. And then the other part of the town would be assigned out, parceled out. The blacksmith shop would be here. The shoemaker, the cobbler would be here. The tailor would be here. See? Very well planned, very cohesive community, but held as a community. So that the town meeting, everybody was there. Whereas in the South, the geography does affect history. The South was not conducive to that. It was better for plantation system. In the South, in 1519, they bring the first, one book I read said the first Negro workers in 1519. And tobacco is the crop, you know, you pay the pasture with tobacco and so on. Well, that requires vast amounts of land, it's a whole different system. Yeah. Any questions? Yeah, they thought they were God's chosen people. Yeah, they were the elect of God, just like Israel was the elect nation. And the logic is this. The logic is this. We are God's redeemed. We are God's regenerate. The unregenerate man doesn't have the capacity to govern. How can he rule for God? Because the state is a reflection of God's authority. No separation of church and state there. That's Roger Williams picking up there. No separation of church and state in Virginia. Okay. Another question. Good. Oh, yeah. Oh, you mean within the colony? No. No, you know, when they came to Plymouth, the Plymouth were really coming to Northern Virginia. And they got blown off course. And they ended up in Cape Cod. Now, technically, Cape Cod was really part of the original Virginia tribe, technically. No, they didn't. But when the Separatist Pilgrims began, they were really supposed to be going to Northern Virginia. And they ended up in Cape Cod. Yes. Oh, you hear? That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. No, the original purpose was not to come for freedom. No. Only from their point of view. Freedom to establish what they wanted. And everybody else had the freedom not to stay there. Yeah. So when you're just say freedom of religion, well, you have to qualify that. When you come to Pennsylvania, you know you have it, because William Penn guarantees it. And the only religion that they would tolerate was theirs, is what I'm saying. Even in Maryland, Lord Calvert was a Catholic, claims to establish religious toleration. But not for Jews, not for anti-Trinitarians. They were under the ban. They were under the threat of death in Maryland. But anybody who believed in Jesus Christ would come to Maryland. That was okay. So what we understand as religious freedom, it has to evolve.
There's going to be reasons in these colonies why these particularisms are going to be broken down. We benefit from a lot of good things by the Puritans, and they are maligned too much for this. They were good people. But they thought they did not allow for a divine institution. They thought that they could unite church and state, and the one church is pushing the state. You can't do that. In the millennium, that's going to be okay. Do you know that in the 1900s in America, there are more efforts at communism in America in the 1900s than probably any place, any time, anywhere, in most of my religions?
They all fail. Everyone's looking for utopia. They're all looking for a millennium. Nothing works. Nothing happens. So Jesus Christ comes. That's what's the name. Meantime, we do the best that we can to keep church and state separate, but not to separate God from the state. That's a mistake too. That's where we've gone too far now, the other way in this country. Okay? Well, we'll talk more about that because we want to lay the groundwork for some of those conclusions. Let's close it there.
To clarify, this will not just be an exercise in the facts of our past, but an intelligent understanding of some of the problems of these early settlers, help us to see things from their point of view and appreciate some of these things that they were trying to do, and yet help us to be objective enough from a divine point of view to honestly face the mistakes that they made. We pause to give you thanks for our nation, for the privileges that we still enjoy, and we fear that our freedoms are fastly disappearing because of massive government of bureaucracy and a trend toward socialism. And we pray that having looked at the struggle of these colonists and of the good thing that emerged in terms of our Constitution, that we will be encouraged to reaffirm some of these things to our age and to the generation that is coming up and will control this country. We ask that you continue to spare us with freedom, and not to be so engulfed with the issue of equality. And we pray that as believers that we will be able to make these issues clear to those who would sacrifice freedom for what they understand as equality. We ask this in Christ's name. Thanks, Jesus. Amen.